And so we come to the third of the five faculties, and which is sati, mindfulness. And it belongs to this amazing, amazing capacity we have to be aware. I mean, how did we end up that way? Were you planning for this? It's amazing. I think of awareness, consciousness, as being the way the universe knows itself. Isn't it pretty cool that the universe gets to know itself through you? That you're the vehicle for that? Pretty amazing. That somehow out of that cosmic soup of evolution of the cosmos, the universe, there evolved living beings that became increasingly conscious, aware, mindful. And here we are with this amazing capacity. I don't think they've figured out how to do it yet with computers. So for the time being, we're pretty unique, at least on this planet. And I think of this capacity to be aware, mindful, consciousness. I think, as I said earlier, it's kind of like the narrow neck of the hourglass, that everything, either side, everything in the vast universe gets channeled through our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, through our awareness, those, and everything inside also comes up somehow, in some way or other, into consciousness and awareness. And this meeting place where all this stuff happens, and we hardly know what's really going on. However, the Buddhist tradition says that no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. That mindfulness is always good. And mindfulness is more than just being conscious. It's being conscious or aware with clarity. The kind of clarity that the Pali word for it is pati sati. And that's a little awkward to translate it literally into English, but it's reflexive awareness. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as lucid awareness. It's awareness is so lucid, so clear, that you know you're aware. You can be aware of all kinds of things, and you know, someone asks you, were you aware of what was for dessert at lunch? Yeah, I was aware of that, for sure. But in the moment of looking at the dessert, to really see it, and to really know that you're seeing it, or have it so lucid, so clear that, oh yeah, not so self-consciously like the way I'm talking about, but, you know, if you go, if you're in the Bay Area, and there are days when it's kind of smoggy, and you can't really see from one side of the bay to the other, and then another day the wind comes in and clears out all the smog, and the air is clear, and you can clearly see the mountains on the other side of the bay, and you know the air is clean. You know it's clear. You know there's this kind of, wow, it's cool. So it's kind of more like that kind of knowing, this kind of click. There's like a heightened clarity on the own. You're really there for something. And Bhikkhu Bodhi these days, and myself, translate the word sati not as mindfulness, but as awareness. And one of the reasons for this is that the Buddhists have long ago lost control of the word mindfulness in English. It was taken from us. And it became this, you know, secular mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness this and mindfulness that. There's books on mindfulness in poker. There's even a book called Mindfulness and Angry Birds. So you name it. You think of it, and there's a mindfulness of or something. And the way that it's a wonderful movement, the secular mindfulness, but the way it's defined or the way mindfulness is described there, it's actually not the same thing as what the Buddha talked about, sati. It's actually a different Buddha term, sampajana. So it resembles the Buddha's teaching, but it's actually a different word. And sati in the suttas is closer to our word awareness. And here's a couple of things that's peculiar about this word sati. Nowhere in the suttas is mindfulness something you're supposed to do. Isn't that a relief? It doesn't say, do the mindfulness now. And, your mother says, be mindful, do mindfulness, pay more attention. My mother told me that a lot. Pay attention to what you're doing. And Buddha talked about the sati, he talked about abiding in it. Abiding, dwelling in sati. He also talked about establishing it, establishing sati. And he talked about cultivating it. Something you cultivate, like a image of a farmer cultivating something, you don't do the plant. You cultivate the plant so it can grow. We create the conditions so sati can grow. And we establish it there, let it grow, and dwell in it. I think that the best English word for that is awareness. We can dwell in awareness. We can cultivate awareness. And so when the Buddha talked about what he meant about having sati, he talked about the four satipatthanas. Usually translated into English as the four foundations of mindfulness, but it's the four ways of establishing mindfulness. The word patthana means establishing rather than foundation. Four ways of establishing it. It's four ways of establishing awareness. And all the exercises given the Buddha gave for what we now call mindfulness practice were practices that cultivate and establish awareness, a lucid awareness, a clear awareness, so that we could, and that makes a world of difference to be aware in a lucid way. So you want to be a little bit careful if you're spending too much time trying to do mindfulness. And I know that some of the ways we teach, it maybe sounds like that's what we're telling you to do. But what the Buddha did was he had particular practices that he emphasized that had different particular verbs associated with them. Do these practices. If you do them, awareness will become stronger, will be established. So, for example, he had death awareness practices. Actually, the terminology is contemplating death, reflecting on death. And if you spend a little bit of time really, some people do at least, when they really reflect on death, and some people really wake up, spend time with a dead person, just someone who just died, and you chances are you will be quite lucidly aware. It's like things really, you're not going to be thinking about, what movies to see Saturday night. You're, usually right there. It's quite a profound and almost sacred thing to be there. So the Buddha talked about, contemplating death as a way of establishing this awareness. The most common way he talked about it was observing. And so we practice observation to look at what's there, to recognize what's there, what's happening. But the point is not just to recognize what's there. The point is somehow by coming back and recognizing the present moment over and over again, it gives birth, it gives rise to stronger and stronger awareness. And then we can rest in that awareness when it becomes strong. Partly because as we keep coming back and do the observation, the mindfulness coming back to the present moment, the forces of distraction fall away. They get weaker and weaker. And then it becomes easier and easier to stay in this awareness field, the field of awareness. So this is important, this idea, because there's the things that we do in the practice and the things that are done to us. There's what we do, a little bit, it's the consequences that arise within us because we do those things. So we do observations, like I watch my breathing, but then you have to also make room for the awareness to arise. It has to be space for something to grow, the awareness to be there. If you're only doing, there's no room for something to happen. No room for the practice to do you. And there's a mutuality, reciprocity in this practice. There's what you offer. I'd like to think of it as your gift, what you offer. And then is what you receive in return. And you have to make room, you have to do both. You have to do your offering, and then you have to make room, give space, make allowance for something to occur which is not your doing. And in mindfulness practice, sati practice, it's the arising of this lucid awareness, this awareness that's here. So I'll say a little bit more about that. For the Buddha, he said that he offered four primary practices of what we observe so that this awareness can be established. There was observation of the body, observation of feeling tone, observation of mind states, and observation of something called dhammas. These are four domains of direct experience that's going on that the Buddha seemed to think were particularly effective for cultivating awareness. So first one is the body, this embodiment, really being present for your body, coming back to your body over and over again. Your body is always in the present moment. It couldn't be anywhere else. And so to use your body as a vehicle to settle into the present moment, to settle here, for your attention to be established in your body, to connect it to your body, you keep coming back to the present moment. As you become aware of the distractions, if you're able to soften those, relax them, no longer be interested in them, no longer bothered by them, a lot of the distractive forces of the mind get quieter. And then you come back more and more to the present. And if you're really present, most people will have a connection to their body. And many of you have had probably more connections with your body than you cared for so far in this retreat. All those ouches, all the, you know, sitting there with the pain. But no mindfulness is wasted. And whatever way in which you manage to navigate the physical discomfort, you are cultivating this awareness, capacity to be here, right here. So the Buddha talked about mindfulness of the body, observing the body. He talked about observing feeling tone, the feeling tone meaning the ways in which things are pleasant or unpleasant. And just to see, oh, this is a pleasant experience, this is an unpleasant experience, is very powerful because it's often based on whether things are pleasant and unpleasant that we have a reaction. And in ordinary life, that reaction can be quite unfortunate. But if you can really see, this is pleasant, here I am, and that's pleasant, then there's a gap for there to be a response rather than a reaction. And a friend of mine who teaches mindfulness in prisons calls mindfulness the mother of all interventions. Remember, he's talking to criminals. The mother of all interventions, because it helps you to see the gap between a reaction and a response, or the difference, and that makes all the difference between committing a crime and not committing it. So to see the, you know, to really kind of notice, but there's something about seeing the pleasant and unpleasant, and seeing you have a choice about whether to grab on or react or push away, and up and kind of negotiating that movement, that tends to heighten the quality of awareness. The awareness gets a little more heightened, gets engaged, gets refined, gets kind of activated as we navigate that terrain. Mind states. Mind states are quite intimate. Mind states can be mind states of, the Buddha talked about mind states of characterized by greed, wanting, mind states that are characterized by aversion, and mind states that are characterized by delusion. And then mind states are characterized by the opposite. He uses the language of non-greed, non-aversion, and non-delusion, and that gives a kind of a range. In Pali, the negative of something like this implies the positive, but implies a range of positive things. So a mind state is characterized by generosity. There's one opposite of greed. A mind state characterized by love is the opposite of aversion. Mind state characterized by clarity or understanding, the opposite of delusion. So to become aware that there's a general field or mood of the mind that actually can have a tremendous influence in coloring how we see the world. And you know, it's people who are not mindful can have an aversive mind state, and they see what's wrong with everything. People who have the mind state characterized by greed or lust will see all the things that are delicious out there. People characterized by delusion will just see everything and not understand it, what's going on. And so it has a tremendous impact on us. But if we can observe and see, oh, here the mind state, there's so much greed going on, it's actually coloring the lens through which I'm seeing the world. That's a little bit of a wake-up call. That's a little bit like, wow, I'm under the influence of something here that's not my choice. Is this how I want to live my life? And to see and watch that is another way of the awareness starts getting activated, or the ability to be kind of alert and, wow, this is interesting. And it's that kind of coming into awareness that what the Buddha was looking for. So the observation is the means through which we're giving birth to this awareness, coming into awareness. So I didn't talk about the fourth one, but these four foundations, these four ways of establishing mindfulness, are very interesting. The Buddha called them your native country. Isn't that nice? He said, stay in your native country, in your native lands. He gave the example of monkeys who, if they lived far up in the mountains where there was kind of very steep cliffs and mountains and terrain, and hunters couldn't get up there, then the monkeys are safe. If they're in the woods, they're pretty safe. But if they come out in the plains away from the woods, then the hunters can catch them. So to be safe, the monkeys should stay in their native lands, up in the forest, high up in the mountains. So if you want to be safe, the Buddha said, stay in your native land. And he called it these four places for establishing mindfulness. Your native land being your body, your feeling tones, your mind states, and how the mind operates in terms of the dharmas. I find it fascinating that this, he would call this the native land, your home place, your hometown kind of thing. Kind of comforting, meaningful place to feel home, place to feel like this is where you live from here. And that's one of the functions of this awareness that gets born, is this idea that we start living from this place. we arrive, the life emanates from this body. The body is not a vehicle to lean forward into the future or forward out there to get something. It's not like we're living out there for what we can get and have and do. We're not leaning into pleasure. We're not pulling away from displeasure. We're not leaning into fantasy. But this something powerful emanates from within, unclouded by all the projections of thoughts and ideas and concepts the mind can have. So in terms of this working mutuality of observing and allowing the awareness to arise, I liken it a little bit to how you would push a scooter. If you you're riding a scooter, you know, one foot's on the, like, I don't know what it's called, but on the board, and the other foot is pushing, and so you push, and most people, I think, at least one nice way to scoot, is you push, and then for a few moments you allow it to roll forward, and then it slows down, starts slowing down, then you push it again to get more momentum. Roll, push, roll, push. And you know, it's kind of a nice rhythm. And people, you can get into the groove of doing that, get quite focused and engaged and just doing it over and over again. And it moves you forward. So similarly, we observe the breathing. Say we just kind of observe the exhale. So we connect to it, feel it, sense it, observe it, whatever language you like. And then as we're observing it, we kind of like let ourselves roll along in it, coast in it, open to it, welcome it into awareness, let it come. Give up the controller, give up the one who's the doer for a moment, to really kind of just connect to the exhale and let go and just, and then receive the experience. And then you connect to the inhale. But the same thing with the inhale, you connect to observe it, to feel it, and then you kind of get out of the way and receive that experience. So it's registering more deeply. So that you're not staying in this dualistic relationship that comes with observing. You're using that dualistic observation to put yourself in the territory in your home country, and then you're getting out of the way to allow something to fill the awareness. And that allows for an intimacy to the experience, a closeness. It becomes very personal and very here. If we stay up in the mind, it, you know, stay dualistic, then it it could easily become cold and distant and unfriendly. So, you know, we observe, we recognize what's there. So the recognition is a very important part of mindfulness. We recognize what's there, and that's the pushing of the foot in the scooter. And once you've recognized it, you don't rush over to recognize the next thing and the next thing. You know, the checklist approach to mindfulness. Got that, you know, just keep going. But rather you recognize it, and it's almost like you recognize it and then you kind of savor it, or you recognize it and you're allowed to come in and feel it. What I've been talking about is that you let the mind become quiet, or a little bit quiet, so there's space and awareness to let it register more fully, the actual experience. The mind is thinking too much, it's doing too much. If we're too much in control of the situation, there's actually very little room and awareness for it to register, to feel it and sense it. And it isn't so much where the point is to not to feel it fully, to let it register. But the point is that in doing that, the awareness starts getting stronger. The awareness then starts standing out. As we do that, all the ways in which we are doing things, preoccupying the mind with thoughts and actions and dreams and versions and preoccupations, begins to quiet down. Because that receptive mode of taking something in for a moment, gliding on the scooter, so gliding and this in-breath, there's a sound. If the sound stays long enough, it's for a moment taking in the sound, really feeling it. Then we're not spinning in our thoughts so much. We're not feeding our thoughts. And the thinking mind, with time, it takes a while, will start quieting down. And the more you give yourself over to this experience of just the simplicity of just being with the breath, being with the experience, receiving it, you know, and kind of a nice, simple rhythm, settling into the groove with the breath, for example, connecting to it, and then gliding with it, or connecting with it and letting it glide across you, glide across awareness. You get into the groove, just do this. And this idea of keeping it really simple and entering into the simple world of the direct moment-to-moment experience can be very powerful. So I'll read you a story. Again, I received my friend who teaches the mindfulness at San Quentin and at the prison. And it was one of his inmates wrote this, inmate learning mindfulness. So it's a little bit an allegory. So this inmate writes, "My night was like any other night. It was 8 p.m., time for close custody count, which means that all prisons have institutional counts wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for count is considered a serious violation. The officer came to our cell and called my bunkie's name, after which he gave him the last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. He called out my name and I gave him my number. Half an hour passed, and a neighbor comes to my cell and says they are paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, 'Why were you not in your cell for count?' I told them, 'I was in my cell for count, as I've been every day and night for 12 years. And I have numerous neighbors that can verify that.' It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again, and I am like, whatever. 2 days go by, and I found out that the sergeant gave me a write-up, a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I truly am not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who will say the same. However, at the hearing, the cop that counted said he looked into the cell two times, and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra work. I said to myself, screw this. I am not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong, and these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. That is, the last thing I wanted to do, but I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do those 40 hours of extra work. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it And regardless of the circumstances and the injustice of it, see if I could do what would ultimately be best for me. She said she would accept what I would decide, but if I could, please act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I have always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere, no matter what. So not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I still felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra work, I set off to shine up that hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the results of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up that fire hydrant, I had become bigger than the unfairness that led me to my assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison. Kind of like a small lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out on how to steer, on how to move through the place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. So, even with the injustice of what he was charged to do, he gave himself completely over to the task of polishing the hydrant. No matter what is going on, it's possible to give yourself completely over to polishing your breathing, or your steps as you walk, or being present for food as you eat. To really give yourself over to that work and just be there just for that. And so that so many things drop away in the simplicity of just this, being with this, being with this. And something gets born, something arises that's beautiful. And one of those things is this clear sense of awareness, clear sense that there's a clear, lucid presence of awareness. And maybe that language is kind of grand, lucid awareness, but it becomes the companion. Awareness is what you use to accompany your experience in your life. And the Buddha talked about that. One of the meanings, one of the ways he talked about sati is to have sati stand near. Let it stand, it stands close. Awareness stands close to us, close to our experience. It stands with our experience. It accompanies our experience. And it makes a world of difference. It's a world of difference between being lost in thought and knowing that you're thinking. It's a world of difference being submerged in emotions and knowing, clearly knowing, there's a lot of emotions. It's a world of difference between, you know, having, being lost in physical discomfort and then having this clear awareness that knows. And this, it's a world of difference. It changes the whole inner ecosystem, that difference. And a fascinating thing to do in this practice is to notice how your inner landscape changes between when you're lost in something and when you kind of, in a sense, step back and see it clearly for what it is. There's a clear awareness that's there. It's kind of like, in physics sometimes they say that the certain physical phenomena, if you observe it, you change it. So you don't, you see, and what you see is already changed by the act of observing. So you don't really see it. It's a little bit like that for us. If the awareness is lucid, we do change the whole inner ecosystem. And there's a whole different way of being in the world with lucid, with clear awareness. And I like to think of it as discovering how to be independent. The Buddha called it being independent in the Dharma. And that was one of the goals in practice, is to learn a certain kind of independence where that comes when awareness is clearly aware, but is not gunked up with, is not clinging to, not stuck to what it is you're aware of. So if I ring the bell, the ringing of the bell doesn't stick to the space that the vibrations travel through. The space has a certain kind of independence from the bell. So awareness can be a little bit like space, and we can know things, but it's kind of like it's known in the spaciousness of awareness, or the non-resistance of awareness. The non-obstruction of awareness. Awareness just knows. And to have that be centered on that, or open to that, or present for that, makes a lot of room, and it's very respectful. I think it's so wonderfully respectful of our life, because in that open awareness, all of who we are has a chance to just move through, to be there. When we're trying to do something with it or fix it, there could be grief, and the grief has lots of room to be there. There can be, you know, all kinds of emotions. There can be all kinds of thoughts that come up. But to know those, whatever is arising in this wider field of clear awareness, there's no problem with anything. We don't have to be involved with, I shouldn't be doing that, I shouldn't be doing that, that's not right. Because in this independence of awareness, there's this lots of space between reaction and response. There's room to be wise about what to say and what to do. But when the mind is claustrophobic and there's no space, no real awareness, then that's when it's very easy to get swept up and caught up in all kinds of things. It's a beautiful thing to allow our life to move through us, to course through us, to let the inner life have its processes and unfold and move and everything. I don't think of mindfulness or this practice as limiting our inner life, but rather giving freedom to it. And what I found is as the mindfulness and the awareness gives freedom to this inner life, there's a tremendous amount of wisdom, tremendous amount of health, resiliency that has a chance to operate. I get the impression that their whole system is set up to move towards a kind of psychological or spiritual health. If we can get out of the way, to sit like this, to be present, and learn how to be aware, it's kind of like learning to get out of the way. Allow things to arise and to pass and to come and to go on their time frame, not on our own. Keep getting out of the way. Create letting this awareness be the space within which what we know comes and goes. So you might, as you practice here on this retreat, to polish your hydrant. You know, it could be with the breathing. Just, you know, connect to the breathing Because when you polish, you have to take the cloth and connect it to the hydrant, and then you rub it. Connect and rub, connect and rub. So connect to your breathing, observe the breathing, and then the rubbing is this kind of just like getting out of the way and allow that act of observation to mature into an open awareness of that full inhale. So the whole inhale has a chance to arise. So there's space for something to happen to you. You kind of give up control, give up trying to make something happen. And then the inhale comes, and you have to do something, and what you do is you connect to the inhale. But once you're connected, for those that moment of inhaling, let go, open up, and really feel the rest of the inhale. Let it come into awareness. As you do walking meditation, same thing. You connect to the foot, maybe it says lifting, and then you kind of just stop the doing in favor of just feeling and sensing, like the sponge that absorbs. Allow the rest of the step to come to you into awareness. Allow the quiet mind to take it in, silent mind to really feel it. So there's room for you to be practiced, not just you practicing, but you're allowing yourself to be practiced. You're allowing yourself to be done too by the practice. And then the next step becomes the next push of the scooter. Connect to the step. Know whether you're stepping. And then take a moment to kind of just allow and feel and let that whole experience be registered in a deeper way, felt in a deeper way. Allow it to come into you. Eating, same thing, whatever you're doing. Now, one of the important arts, important kind of secrets, open secrets of this kind of retreat practice is what's called continuity of practice. The whole day is your fire hydrant. Stay with it. Just keep doing it. So have a seamless time. So that means that the end of the sitting, don't let it be an end. Just now do standing up meditation. Walking out of here, do walking meditation going out of here. Whatever you're doing, give yourself over to it. Just this. And see if you can maybe do this rhythm of observing what's there, recognizing what's there, and in the wake of the recognition, take a moment to just glide into the experience, with the experience. Let it come into you. Let it glide across your awareness. Let it come into you. And then you're in the groove, right? So when you push the scooter and you glide, push the scooter, you glide. So recognize. So you're walking down the steps. Recognize the stepping. And then open to feel the foot going down to the next step. Then recognize that the foot begins to lift. And then allow yourself to feel that. You can do that really carefully and slowly, unless there's other people behind you on the steps. Then you should probably go a little faster. And then as the awareness, those times, doesn't happen automatically, but those times when awareness is strong, there will come a time where you feel like the best thing you can do is just keep just resting in it, allowing it, just being, kind of settling back, just being awareness, as opposed to doing the the mindfulness thing, becoming it. And it, you know, to really get the hang of it and feel it deeply, it's really like touching some of the most intimate parts of who we are, some of the most freest parts, some of the most precious and valuable parts of who we are. Settled, whole, integrity. And then it's very interesting, this word integrity in Latin. It means that which can't be touched. Isn't that fascinating? There was really, many people really love the word integrity. That which can't be touched. This lucid awareness. It's like space. Can you really touch the space in the room? That doesn't quite compute, does it? You don't touch space exactly. So the awareness, you really touch awareness? It's something within that can't be harmed, can't be hurt. In and of itself can't cause harm, can't cause any hurt. That feels like some of the most intimate and deepest and connected parts of who we are. It's a wonderful thing. So sati, the faculty of sati. And if what I've said today about sati, mindfulness, doesn't make a lot of sense to you, don't worry about it too much. You just have to be aware enough for it to be onward leading. Just do your best. Be content with how you're aware, how you're mindful, and just keep doing it, and it'll work itself out. And especially if you kind of make everything your hydrant, just give yourself over to what you're doing. Be aware the best way you know how, and see what opens up for you. So thank you.